Abbey 104.
Hello, good morning, it's Abbey 104, it's 5 past 11 on Sunday morning, it's time for Folk Tales. I'm Terry Bennett, and my guest this morning in the studio is David Hayes. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Terry, and morning to your very loyal many listeners, no doubt.
Yes, absolutely. And David, you are the chairman of the Friends of the Yettman Hospital.
Yes, indeed, my great pleasure to be that as well.
Tell us just briefly about the Friends of the Yettman. I mean, most people will know about the Yettman Hospital, but what do the Friends do?
Well, it actually continues the tradition of private support to the Yettman Hospital, one of the gems of Sherborne and the local community. Bearing in mind that the Yettman was established in 1866 by a foundation of the Yettman family, and they even then supported by public donation. And notwithstanding the Yettman is now part of the NHS since 1946. It is still very much a major contribution from the Friends, who are all volunteers. Actually, of today, we stand at 1,540 Friends, which is a substantial number.
It's huge, isn't it?
Who willingly give their donations, financial donations. But also, we have a wide range of volunteers who give off their services almost on a daily basis to the Yettman. And so notwithstanding the very excellent service that Matron Anne Hiscock provides with her staff for the NHS, the Friends, we believe, we have an object really to enhance the experience of all those that are coming in contact with the Yettman, be that if they're resident as patients or as outpatients, or indeed supported by the Yettman through the hub, which has a very broad reach now throughout Sherborne and the local area, local communities, assisting all aspects of medical welfare. And to support all that, the Friends, I've got a very distinguished committee who support me in arranging a number of events, fundraising efforts. We're very lucky this year to be selected by Sainsbury's as being their charity of the year. Just last weekend, we had a very successful Sherborne Chase sponsored by the Sherborne Sports Centre, which was really successful, I believe, as demonstrating the support for the Friends throughout the community and throughout all age groups. And we have certainly in this last 18 months or so had an initiative to garner the support of our local schools, which actually education is almost the local industry of Sherborne. And we've had some excellent visits, particularly from the International School, the Griffin, Sherborne Boys and Sherborne Girls and Lewiston to the Yettman. Really is encouraging at the lower sixth level those who may in the future have an interest in the medical profession. So it has got a very broad reach, the Friends of Yettman. I think it's has a good reputation because it's supporting such a fantastic hospital. And all those that come in contact with the hospital tend to show off their gratitude by being very generous towards the Friends, either in donations or indeed legacies. And
right.
I'm very privileged to be their chairman.
It's clearly a very vibrant and go-ahead organisation. We'll talk more on that subject later in the interview. But as we always do, we'll have a wander through your life, if we may. But maybe start with your first music selection, which is Dame Kirita Kanawa and the English Chamber Orchestra singing a piece by Joseph Cantelube. And why have you chosen this?
It's the Songs of the Averne. This was chosen by my wife to be sung at our wedding. And it's a collection of folk songs from the Auvergne region of France. And it's sung the local language. And it's really a shepherdess calling across the valley to the shepherd and trying to entice him to her side, bearing in mind there was sort of meadows were then in bloom and there were water dividing. It's rather ironic, actually, because throughout the period of our engagement, my wife was My fiancée at the time was a nurse at the Westminster Hospital in London, and I was serving in Hong Kong. So the valley was quite broad from UK to Hong Kong. But it was at our wedding, and it's always been a very dear song to me, and also, I believe, to my wife.
All right, let's hear it. Well, it seems a great shame to fade that. That's a collection of folk songs from the Auvergne region of France, written by Joseph Canteloup between 1923 and 1930, sung by Kirita Kanawa and chosen by my guest in the studio today, David Hayes, who is chairman of the Friends of the Yetman Hospital. David, we'll talk certainly more about the Friends and what they do and what they've achieved over the years later in the interview, but where did it all begin for you? Are you a local person?
Not quite to Dorset, but local to the West Country. I had the privilege of being brought up in Devon. My father served in the Second World War in the Burma campaign. My maternal grandparents went to India in the early 30s, as my mother followed them when she was a young girl. So my parents, they met in India, and left India in 1946 on partition, and came back to UK, went out to East Africa, Kenya. My father served with the Colonial Medical Service as a doctor, and then after 4 or 5 years returned to Devon, where my maternal grandparents had had previously lived, and he joined a general practitioner's practice in Newton Abbot, where I was brought up, and spent my childhood in Devon, just south of the magnificent Dartmoor and just very close to the coast, and Tingmouth and Shoreland and Dartmouth, and found a great love for the country and the hills. And I went to prep school in Newton Abbot prior then to becoming more of a Dorset man. In terms of going to school at Dorhallows, which was just about 5 miles west of Lyme Regis on the Devon-Dorset border, and had my public school years there. Most of the time swoven in coastal mists of the Dorset coastline and the Jurassic coastline, and that's really sort of where the connections of Dorset started.
I see.
Without sort of great plan at all, but and then from school I would have loved to have gone into the medical profession, but academically was not for me, so I went elsewhere. My second desire was to join the army, and I went luckily passed into Sandhurst, and from there I went into a full career.
Okay, before we get into the military career, which is another story in itself, your days at prep school then, tell me about that.
I think of my school days, I would actually probably say that my prep school was probably the most formative. As one goes through life, one tends to think, well, what would so-and-so thought about that? And I tend to relate back to my old headmaster and just say, well, what would Mr. Day have said about that, rather than any particular other element of my education? And people have other links. But I found it was a traditional prep school round about sort of the 95 mark, which probably not sustainable nowadays, but therefore was very much a second family to me. Mm-hmm. And it was in my hometown, and I loved it.
I see. So enjoyable school days on the whole?
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and
perhaps I should have worked harder, but I love the sport.
Academically, then, you alluded to the fact that maybe you weren't going to make the required levels to be
a
doctor, but you were okay.
I seemed to be okay.
Yep. Yes,
cut my groove elsewhere.
So, your father had been in the military. Was that always likely to be on the horizon then for you?
I think so. He was of that generation where he had a distinguished and gallant war that he kept it very much to himself, which we all respected, as indeed my father-in-law, who was a very distinguished and decorated bomber pilot. The only time I've actually knew my father really to open up was actually to my father-in-law, because they were sort of the similar generation and similar experience, and they could relate to things. So yes, my father did have a very distinguished career. He had a very distinguished career in medicine. My mother would refuse to go shopping with my father, because he would be going down Queen Street, Newton Abbot, doing all his various consultancies. But that's the way of the country general practitioner of those days.
So Sandhurst it was going to be then, ultimately.
Yes.
Presumably you had to get some level of qualification to get there. But
yes, you go through a very rigorous selection process, with the commissions board, which tests all facets of your yes. character, your personality, and your skills. And I was lucky enough to get myself there, and had appeared at time at Sandhurst, which again was another life-enhancing experience.
Well, some might say it's quite an elitist establishment. Did you find it that way?
I wouldn't say it's elitist, because that gives the air of sort of, you know, an element of a sort of pomposity. It's not. Anybody that can make the grade from any background can become an officer and a leader and a commander. I would like to say it's one of the best, if not the best, military academy in the world, alongside other distinguished military academies, and I would hope everybody would expect that to be,
yes.
because they want their services to be commanded by high-grade professionals, which I think our armed services are. But I wouldn't say as elitist, but it's a tough one to get into.
Yes, no, quite rightly. And quite a challenging environment when you're there, I would imagine. Yeah, they expect high standards, certainly.
Expect high standards, and you've got to meet them. But part of the military aspect with all that is a sense of humour. And you laugh at yourself first, and as long as you can do that, you'll enjoy the soldiers' banter. It's challenging. It's physically challenging. It's mentally challenging. You're continually put under duress to establish how you're going to react in challenging circumstances, because you are training for the ultimate bad idea. And you've got to be able to sustain yourself, but more importantly, to sustain those under your command whose lives you're responsible for.
Absolutely. But I imagine you make some very strong friendships, which probably stay with you.
Yes, strong friendships. And those friendships are throughout the rank structure. Mm. And some very loyal friendships. Mm. And often quoted as being friendships that perhaps only soldiers understand, yeah. Which is probably similar to anybody else who is in a specialist community, working under pressure, medical professional,
yes,
professional,
they operating
all have
theaters,
sort of
yes.
friendships and bonds, born of
the stress of the situation.
Experience. Mm.
All right. Well, we'll talk maybe a little bit more about that in a minute, but let's have your second choice. This is Pearl Fisher's Duet. Tell us about this.
Well, Placido Domingo and Nuova Bacilli. This is another favourite in our household, much by the guidance of my wife, who is very much more distinguished in classical music than I am. But I relate to the Pearl Fisher's Duet, right, sort of like what as Shakespeare referred to it, sort of full fathom five, my father lies, of his bones are coral made, those are pearls that were once his eyes, nothing of him that doth fade. And I think it's very endearing, the whole aspect of thinking of those jewels under the sea and the quest to go and find them.
All right, let's hear it.
It's a lovely melody. Frotino dei miei pele lo temo lo fu la pr.
elle fuit, elle fuit.
Well, that was Placido Domingo and Andrea Bocelli there with the Pearl Fishers duet from, I'll try and pronounce this, Les Pêcheurs de Pearl by Georges Bizet. And that's chosen by David Hayes, who's the chairman of the Friends of the Yetman Hospital. And David, we got to the point where you were at Sandhurst and enjoyed that experience by the sound of it.
Hindsight.
Yeah, not necessarily while you were there. No. And you left Sandhurst. So what happened next? You were obviously then commissioned to enter a regiment.
Yes, well, a part of the process at Sandhurst is deciding which part of the army one wishes to go into, whether you want to go into one of the teeth fighting arms or one of the support services. And much is really dependent upon what one's own ambitions are and where you're actually sitting within the Order of Merit. And as a good Devon boy, I was very happy and very proud to have put my name forward and being selected for the Devon and Dorset Regiment. But whilst at Sandhurst, we came across a number of Gurkhas who were providing various support to various exercises at Sandhurst in terms of demonstrations. And they were pretty impressive in terms of their fitness and their sort of joie de vivre and their overall professionalism. And I thought perhaps I might look at the Gurkhas. And fortunately, my instructor told me at the time, well, actually, Hayes, you've got to buck up because there's a certain benchmark that they have and you're not on it yet. So I spent the last few months bucking up and discussing it with my father, who had some experience serving with Gurkhas as a doctor in the Indian Army. And I put my name forward and was very privileged to being selected to be commissioned into the 7th Duke of Edinburgh's own Gurkha Rifles. And that was a major impact on my life because I was then swept up from being a West Country boy to be a Far Eastern boy, serving out in the Far East and Hong Kong and Brunei in the jungles, honing jungle warfare skills and the Hong Kong border when it was still very sensitive between Hong Kong and then communist China. And much of my life in the Far East started from that point.
All right. So you started in Hong Kong, but you've mentioned other postings there.
Yes, it was. We had a battalion stationed in Brunei, which is the jungle warfare centre for the British Army, and of course the soldiers coming from Nepal spent many weeks trekking in the Himalayas on various welfare treks and paying pensions, and that really sort of really broadened my horizons, for which I've always been extremely grateful for. And then on top of that, there were then tours back to Europe, into Germany, and into, of course, Northern Ireland in those days, and Londonderry, and back again to the Far East. So one was leaping around the part of the world, as any soldier does, pretty rapidly.
The Gurkhas have got perhaps a unique reputation, haven't they, as being an excellent fighting force as well. They're steeped in tradition, aren't they, as well? How did you find that culture? You had to go and immerse yourself in that.
Yes, I think for any soldier or leader, you know, command of other men, it's a huge privilege to command anybody and to lead anybody, particularly in the circumstances which we are trained for lead, as sort of for, you know, the ultimate tests. And that is a privilege. to then put yourself forward to do that command leadership in another language and commanding and leading soldiers of a different nationality from a totally different social background to yours, and also of a different faith. And faith is very important because every soldier has a god in the battlefield, no matter what they might say. Mm. And my soldiers were predominantly Hindu or Buddhist, and therefore being able to extract from them what was required of them. And it's a mix which has been very successful. You've got the traditional Gurkha tribal warrior instinct mixed with the ability of British officers to be accepted, I emphasise, to be accepted by them to command them. And it's a mutual trust, it's a mutual understanding. It's a mutual element of good humour as well. And it's worked for 200 years. Mm. But it is a great privilege to be able to do that in those circumstances and attract the respect, or at least their agreement, that where they've got a tradition of warriorship, that this young pup of 20 years of age will sort of come along and look after their interests, which is the same for anybody, young British officer going to any regiment. You've got to, garner that respect and support, but doing it in a foreign language and doing it with those of different faith is a bit of a challenge. And my God, they're slip-ups. And this is why I said initially in my comments, you've got to be able to laugh at yourself first. Yes. Mm. And because, but I never found the Gurkhas laughing at me. They'd laugh with me because it was fun. Mm. But they'd never laugh at you. No. They would laugh with you. But we'd get over it.
What they call a steep learning curve anyway in the early days.
Yeah, I'm still at it too.
Yes. You mentioned Northern Ireland as being an inevitable posting in those days, because we were at the height of the troubles in Northern Ireland. How did you find that?
Mid-70s, yes. And this may make the point that Gurkhas did not serve in Northern Ireland, because Northern Ireland was considered quite rightly a sort of, dare I say, a home base issue, home base problem. So I had the privilege of being seconded in order to get that contemporary Northern Ireland experience. I served with the 23rd of Foot, the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. I had a tour with them for about 18 months, a part in Germany and part in Northern Ireland. And again, another fascinating experience and fantastic soldiers to work with. Quite tribal in their own way.
Yes.
Yeah, they were very much Northern Welsh, and Cardiff was a very foreign country, foreign city.
But Northern Ireland, of course, was an active conflict zone, wasn't it, in those days? And very different, I imagine, from the Far East. You had to adapt your style.
Yes. Of course, there was nothing similar in the Far East. There had been some difficulties and troubles within Hong Kong, but relatively speaking, it was fairly benign. But one went through a very rigorous training process, and one thought that you went into that theatre pretty confident that you had good training, but one also had a respect for the other side. There's not respect for their political leaning, but respect for their ability, because if you don't respect your adversary, he's going to catch you out. Mm. And so there was that respect across the divide. But like with any other officer of my time, it was a formative experience, and it was a common experience.
You ended up back in Brunei, though, in command of...
Yes, I was privileged eventually to convince people that I could do a reasonable job, and commanded my Gurkha battalion in Brunei. And North Borneo, the Sultanate of Brunei, very close relationship between UK United Kingdom government and the Bruneian government, and particularly a close relationship between the Sultanate and our royal family, and stationed in the coast, North Borneo coast, on the South China Sea, with a British garrison alongside with all our families. And I would emphasise the significance of that in terms of the close bonding that was required, and the it might sound very luxurious being a sort of North Borneo coast, but you were there as a fairly isolated garrison in North Borneo, on North Borneo coast. Your families were there. We were very much an independent unit. We were very much dependent on each other to support ourselves. That's not just the soldiery, but our wives as well. And of course, as always, the wives of officers and soldiers have a great deal to do every 2 to 3 years to re-establish a community and make that community work and support one another. And I've always been utterly indebted to my own wife, but all those that have served with our regiments to make that military community work in very challenging times, a long way away from their own families and children, moving backs and forwards to boarding schools. It was a marvellous experience. It had its challenges, and we all got through it.
Good. Right. Let's take your third track. This is Bob Dylan and Blown in the Wind. Why this one?
Well, this is fairly contemporary stuff. Yes. So we're going back to sort of the early 60s. And Blowing in the Wind, really sort of, perhaps looking in hindsight, one thinks one's got a sort of fairly planned life ahead of you with a career and family, but I think sort of Blowing in the Wind just demonstrates in hindsight, you know, life is pretty uncertain. It is all blowing in the wind and always will be. And therefore all the more important that you have a sort of work hard to have a sound, well-established family life on which you can reach out and deploy your talents, whatever you had, to support others. But it's all pretty uncertain, and it always will be. But stick
right.
at it.
Here's Bob Dylan.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many years can a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? Yes, and how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Yes, and how many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many times must a man look up before he can see the sky? Yes, and how many ears must one man have before he can hear people cry? Yes, and how many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Blowing in the Wind by Bob Dylan from 1963, chosen by David Hayes, who's my guest in the studio today. David, your military career was long and took you in all sorts of directions, but eventually the time came to retire. And how did all that come about?
That came about in 2011, when due time came to hang up my spurs. And I did so as my final appointment as Colonel Brigadier Gurkhas. And then Kofsu takes a certain amount of adjustment. We'd actually moved to some form of adjustment, as one does. And we'd actually, my family, had actually established ourselves here in Sherburn from the mid-90s. And we originally bought a property in Henstridge, and that was quite successful. But then we had developed that property and then went back into full military service again for various reasons. And then that gave us time to look again in this area for another home. We had our elder three sons at school locally in the area, and also our twins as well. So we chosen the area initially because of the good schooling. We'd also had parents. My parents were in Devon. My parents-in-law were retiring to Devon, and therefore, you know, Sherburn became a good locality in that regard, looking so we could actually manage all our responsibilities and be not too far for myself from settling here as a home, to, you know, reach out to all the various military organisations to which I went out while I was still serving. And of course my wife, you know, established a very successful couture dressmaking business here as well. So it fitted in well for us in Sherburn. But then when I left the army, one was obviously looking for other elements to do, and I'd been fortunate enough to be invited on to boards of trustees of another charity. That's the Gurkha Welfare Trust, which does the welfare for our Gurkhas, primarily back in Nepal, but also increasingly here in the UK as well. And also working with an international security company, so that I didn't get completely idle. And then it was during that period, from about 2011, and then from in 2015, I was invited to join the committee of the Friends of Yetman, bearing in mind that my wife had actually, you know, served very successfully on the committee herself. So I was aware from her work the committee of the Friends of the Yetman. And then I was invited to join the committee in 2015, and then subsequently invited to take on the chairmanship, which I've privileged to do for the last almost 3 years now.
You accepted that invitation quite readily then, because you already knew all about the Friends of the Yetman.
Well, I was very humbled to do that, and it was an element that much of my work and my charitable work was, you know, away from Sherburn. So it was an element I could actually give some back of my services, if it was required, into the local community. And I couldn't have found a better avenue to do that.
You gave us a little bit of a summary of the Friends at the top of the programme, but they're not a new group, are they? One imagines that the need for funding in the current economic climate is greater than it ever was, but the Friends of hospitals have been going for decades, haven't they?
And yes, I imagine this one too. Indeed, and I think they're a very valuable element. First of all, they keep the local community in touch with what is happening in their local hospital. Now, notwithstanding the, you know, very excellent service that the NHS provides, it is, you know, a government organisation working to the challenges of any such organisation, be that financial or moral or social. And the Friends, I would judge, is able to, as long as it establishes the right relationships, and I think I've inherited with the Friends from my predecessor, Mike Hatch, and his committee, a very good relationship with the Dorset Healthcare Trust. So it's not adversarial at all. It's very much working as a team effort to be able to keep, you know, the government element in touch, you know, feet on the ground, so to speak, with the community, and be able to represent the community's interests, not continually, you know, banging on the table, but in terms of how one can make it better. And this is an element of this, is the philosophy behind the Friends as I see it, is being able to add on, you know, value added to the very excellent service the NHS provides through the Yetman Hospital and all the staff there. At the hospital, to some value added. It's almost going from, wouldn't probably to start to say going from an economy class to business class, but it's that sort of element from providing, you know, our very industrious volunteers on a daily basis out on the wards, theirs with their trolleys, providing extra elements of sustenance to our patients, even the element of, you know, a conversation, linkage with the patients, other than the very excellent medical staff who are there primarily for the medical bit, but the volunteers being in that human element, you know, from the outside, plus, you know, providing the services that we provide and which we fund. That's in throughout the wards and in the Willows, but also, you know, we've developed elements within the actual infrastructure, and this is quite a piece to be appropriately managed diplomatically and philosophically, because ultimately the infrastructure is a government infrastructure, and we are handling on behalf of the friends and our donors what is actually private charitable trust money. And we might say, well, these things should be done by the NHS. We all understand, you know, the challenges that the NHS has to provide, you know, the basic very excellent services, but with private money we are able to add value to that. And there have been, you know, a variety of areas that we've done this. We've got a magnificent little garden within the centre of the Willows, and that is maintained, you know, in part with volunteers who go in and do the gardening, and that's a great respite for the patients. There's a day room which we were also able to provide. No, it's not essential to the hospital, but it just provides a more humanistic environment for the patients to go through their Yetman experience, and others on the sort of more towards, you know, when life is getting difficult for families. They've got two suites there. One is the Jean King suite and the Ada Cavell suite, whereby families can have some privacy together with their ailing parent or their relative. It's not isolated, but privately cocooned away from the hubbub of the wards, going through a difficult phase of their lives together. And those elements would not happen without the friends. But in addition to that, it's the what we can provide for the outpatients, giving the outpatients, you know, the dignity of decent changing rooms before they're having an x-ray, for example, or actually just enhancing some of the x-ray equipment. Yes, very good as it is, but if you provide, for example, a particular x-ray couch, as we have done, that enables the staff to get the patient absolutely in the right position, and for that patient to be absolutely in the right position without pain, and therefore producing a better product in terms of the x-ray. And that's all the enhancements that we're able to add on to it. And to support us in that, it comes from a whole variety of ways, from, you know, collecting tins to surprisingly substantial legacies. And it's not just from Sherwood, it's not just from the communities. You know, a few months ago we received one from Canada. We thought it was spam, but we dug down, and it was very genuine. So there's a broad reach, and that's indicative of the Yetman being remembered. It's being remembered by the relatives of those that have passed on, and it may have been sort of 4 or 5 years since the parent had passed on, but then a legacy arrives, and that's very humbling. So it is ultimately a community hospital. It's a community funded hospital by the tradition of the Yetman, has been since 1866, I said in the introduction, but very much in step with contemporary medicine. And over the last 18 months, a substantial review through the Dorset Healthcare Trust as to where healthcare was going in the Dorset area, and particularly the North Dorset area, and by its own, you know, reputation inherently by the staff. And yes, we all get attached to buildings, but, and you know, there is this iconic building at the top of Hospital Lane looking down on the West of Sherland, that benevolence of the building, but it's the services that that building produces that really counts. And I'm delighted that the staff have proven themselves in that regard, and that the Yettman, I believe, has got a very valuable future and very valuable contribution to continue to make to Sherburn and its local communities. But the thanks goes to Matron and her staff, and the thanks also goes to the friends who subscribe to it, and all our volunteers. I'm just lucky enough to be talking about it to you. Thank you.
Right. Let us just have your penultimate track, and then we'll come back and talk briefly again about where the friends are headed. This is John McCormack, and When Irish Eyes Are Smiling. Does this have some significance? I imagine so.
Yes, this is a nod to my father, who is from the Emerald Isle, and very much... in terms of any relationship I have with the medical profession, it goes through back to, well, it actually goes to my wife, my mother-in-law, my sister, my aunt, and my father, and indeed my father back to my grandfather, who was a professor of medicine in University College Dublin. So this is going back to the Emerald Isle. Whilst I'm very proud of my West Country roots, I've got a bit of that Irish blood somewhere in my veins.
All right, When Irish Eyes Are Smiling.
There's a tear in your eye, and I'm wondering why, for it never should be there at all. With such power in your smile, sure as dawn you'd beguile, so there's never a teardrop should fall. When your sweet lilting laughter is like some fairy song, and your eyes twinkle bright as can be, you should laugh all the while, and all other times smile, and now smile a smile for me. When Irish eyes are smiling, sure it's like a morning spring. In the lilt of Irish laughter, you can hear the angels sing. When Irish hearts are happy, all the world seems bright and gay. And when Irish eyes are smiling, they steal your heart away.
Well, we're going to have to cut John McCormack a little bit short because we're running a bit short on time ourselves. That was When Irish Eyes Are Smiling, recording from way back in 1916. David, we've talked quite a bit about the current work of the Friends of the Yettman. What do you need? People listening now, so say, oh, yes, I was at the Yettman Hospital or had a relative that was, want to get involved. Where's your current need?
Asking the current friends to keep going, being fantastically supportive of what we do. I'd also ask my committee to bear with me and keep going with my chairmanship for foreseeable future. I'm hugely honoured to have that position. As to anybody that's listening who is not a friend of the Yettman, do please go to our website and look and see all that is on the website. It describes past events and our future intended events and how we interlink and relate to the NHS, formerly through the Dorset Healthcare Trust, but also how we relate to the community of Sherburn. And an element of that community of Sherburn, I would add, the Chamber of Commerce and the Town Council. This is not a sole issue. This is a community issue, and I'm very humbled by the support we get from the local businesses. We've got the festive Sunday coming up on the 2nd of December. We'll be integrated on that within Cheap Street. And look at all the other events we do. And if you have an inclination, think, oh, yes, I've got a good memory of the Etman, or even as an insurance policy, I might need the Etman in a few years' time, do think about becoming a friend. It's a great community. It's a great hospital. It serves a super community, and it's one that we can be really proud of. And particularly, as ever, I'd always say it all comes down to Anne Hiscock, matron, and her staff, and let's continue to support them.
And what are the plans for the future?
In terms of the Etman, to reassure people, as far as I'm aware, it's staying. And it's going to be further developed in various ways. It's taking on a number of more specific technical medical procedures. We're steady as we are in terms of the actual groundworks and the infrastructure. We will continue to enhance it and to modernise it. But we as a committee, from the strategy point of view, from the financial strategy point of view, we husband our resources so that should we require to do some surge work in support of the NHS future plans of the Etman, we'll be there ready to support them.
Time has caught up with us, David, I'm afraid. It's been fascinating talking to you, and we wish the Friends and you as chairman of the Friends every success in the future, and hope that people will get in contact with you and continue to support it. We're going to go out with your final piece, which is a call back to your military days, isn't it? This is the Brigade of Gurkhas, the band of the Brigade of Gurkhas.
Yes, it's a tune that's very provocative. It's high on the hill. It looks to far horizons. It relates to where our soldiers came from the high Himalayas. But whatever in life, there's always another horizon. Look over it and enjoy pursuing it. And I will do the same as Chairman of Friends. And Terry, thank you very much indeed, and your listeners, for your time this morning.
David Hayes, thank you very much for being with us.